Nothing very exciting at the next place. I kept the triumph out of my voice as we drove away. Just a bullock with a tumour on its jaw. But it's an interesting herd. All Galloways. And this group we're going to see have been wintered outside. They're the toughest animals in the district. Carmody nodded. Nothing I said seemed to rouse much enthusiasm in him. For myself, this herd of untamed black cattle always held a certain fascination. Contacts with them were always coloured by a degree of uncertainty. Sometimes you could catch them to examine them. Sometimes you couldn't. As we approached the farm, I could see a bunch of about 30 bullocks streaming down the scrubby hillside on our right. The farm men were driving them down through the scattered gorse bushes and the sparse group of trees to where the stone walls met in a rough V at the front. One of them waved to me.
"We're going to try to get a rope on him down in the corner while he's among his mates. He's a whip bugger. You'd never get near him in field."
After a lot of shouting and waving and running about, the bullocks were finally cornered and they stood in a tight, uneasy pack, their shaggy black poles bobbing among the steam rising from their bodies.
"There he is! You can see the thing on his face!"
A man pointed to a big beast about the middle of the bunch and began to push his way towards him. My admiration for the Yorkshire farm worker rose another notch as I watched him squeezing between the plunging, kicking animals.
"When I get the rope on his head, we'll all have to get to the end. One man'll never hold him,"
he gasped as he fought his way forward. He was obviously an expert, because as soon as he got within reach, he dropped the halter onto the bullock's head with practiced skill.
"Right,"
he shouted.
"Give me a hand with him. We have him now."
But as he spoke, the beast gave a great bellow and began to charge from the pack. The man cried out despairingly and disappeared among the hairy bodies. The rope whipped free out of reach of everybody, except Carmody. As the bullock shot past him, he grabbed the trailing rope with a reflex action and hung on. I watched, fascinated, as man and beast careered across the field. They were travelling away from me towards the far slope. The animal head down, legs pistoning, going like a racehorse, the student also at full speed but very upright, both hands on the rope in front of him, a picture of resolution. The men and I were helpless spectators, and we stood in a silent group as the beast turned left suddenly and disappeared behind a clump of low trees. It was gone for only a few moments, but it seemed a long time, and when it reappeared it was going faster than ever, hurtling over the turf like a black thunderbolt. Carmody, incredibly, was still there on the end of the rope, and still very upright. But his strides had increased to an impossible length, till he seemed to be touching the ground only every 20 feet or so. I marvelled at his tenacity, but obviously the end was near. He took a last few soaring, swooping steps, then he was down on his face, but he didn't let go. The bullock, going better than ever, had turned towards us now, dragging the inert form apparently without effort, and I winced as I saw it was heading straight for a long row of cowpats. It was when Carmody was skidding face down through the third heap of muck that I suddenly began to like him. And when he finally did have to release his hold and lay for a moment motionless on the grass, I hurried over to help him up. He thanked me briefly, then looked calmly across the field at a sight which is familiar to every veterinary surgeon, his patient thundering out of sight across the far horizon. The student was almost unrecognizable. His clothes and face were plastered with filth, except where the saffron streaks of the istin showed up like war paint. He smelt abominably. He had been bitten in the backside. Nothing had really gone right for him all day, yet he was curiously undefeated. I smiled to myself. It was no good judging this bloke by ordinary standards. I could recognize the seeds of greatness when I saw them. Carmody stayed with us for 2 weeks, and after that first day, I got on with him not so badly. Of course, it wasn't the same relationship as with other students. There was always a barrier of reserve. He spent a lot of time squinting down the practice microscope at blood films, skin scrapings, milk smears, and by the end of the day he had collected a fresh supply of samples from the cases he had seen. He would come and drink a polite beer with me after an evening's call, but there was none of the giggling over the day's events as with the other young lads. I had the feeling always that he would rather have been writing up his casebook and working out his findings. But I didn't mind. I found an interest in being in contact with a truly scientific mind. He was as far removed as he could be from the traditional studious swot. His was a cold, superior intellect, and there was something rewarding in watching him at work. I didn't see Carmody again for over 20 years. I picked out his name in the record when he qualified with top marks. Then he disappeared into the great world of research for a while to emerge with a PhD, and over the years he added a string of further degrees and qualifications. Every now and then an unintelligible article would appear in the professional journals under his name, and it became commonplace when reading scientific papers to see references to what Dr. Carmody had said on the subject. When I finally did see him, he was the guest of honour at a professional banquet, an international celebrity heavy with honours. From where I was sitting at the far end of one of the side tables, I listened to his masterly speech with a feeling of inevitability. The wide grasp of his subject, the brilliant exposition. I had seen it all coming those many years ago. Afterwards, when we had left the tables, he moved among us, and I gazed with something like awe at the majestic figure approaching. Carmody had always been big, but with the tailcoat tight across the massive shoulders and the vast expanse of gleaming shirt front stretched over the curving abdomen, he was almost overpowering. As he passed, he stopped and looked at me. "It's Harriet, isn't it?" The handsome, high-coloured face still had that look of calm power. "Yes, it is. It's good to see you again." We shook hands. "And how is the practice at Darrowby?" "Oh, as usual," I replied. "Bit too busy at times." "We could do with some help, if you ever felt like it." Carmody nodded gravely. "I'd like that very much. It would be good for me." He was about to move on when he paused. "Perhaps you'd let me know any time you want a pig bled?" For a moment, we looked into each other's eyes, and I saw a small flame flicker briefly in the frosty blue. Then he was gone. As I looked at the retreating back, a hand gripped my arm. It was Brian Miller, a happily obscure practitioner like myself. "Come on, Jim, I'll buy you a drink," he said. We went into the bar and ordered two beers. "That Carmody," Brian said. "The man's got a tremendous brain, but by God, he's a cold fish." I sipped at the beer and looked thoughtfully into my glass for a few seconds. "Oh, I don't know," I said. "He certainly gives that impression, but Carmody's all right."